Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, February 13th, day number 44 of 2014. And tonight we're going to be doing our second annual Valentine's Day show, and we'll be joined tonight by Leslie Eastman, as well as Barry Jacobson, and a couple of other friends of our show, Tercy Biddenberg, as well as Fernando Hernandez, who are going to be joining us to talk about their favorite couples. Altogether, we're going to be looking back at nine couples in world history. And we'll be talking about them and telling you a little bit about their story. So it's going to be a great show tonight. If you like history, this is going to be a great show. If you like romance, this is also going to be a great show. I think you're going to have a wonderful time tonight as we look at the great icons of love. That's the name of the program. We'll be looking at some of these great couples in world history. Of course, just a little plug here for my book, Cubanos in Wisconsin. The book is available in print as well as Kindle. You can get the book at the Amazon. You can order the book directly from the Amazon, or you can go to our website, Cubanos in Wisconsin, and get yourself a copy of the book. One of the benefits of getting the book from the website, Cubanos in Wisconsin, one of the benefits is that you can get a dedicated copy of the book. And that's a fun thing to do. You can get the book dedicated to you or to a family member or maybe a loved one or maybe a Cuban grandmother. That's always one of my favorite dedications when we get to dedicate a book to a Cuban grandmother. So anyway, CubanosInWisconsin.com and get yourself a copy of the book. We're going to take a little break tonight. This is going to be a little different format of a show. Normally we do a show that is very much interested or very much focused on issues and current events. Today we're moving that aside and focusing on romance and love and these great couples in history. So we're also going to have a little music tonight on the show. I've selected a few musical pieces tonight that I hope you'll enjoy. And in fact, as we travel to San Diego to catch up with Leslie Eastman, I've got one here that I really like. This is a group called Blue Jar, just like it sounds, blue, the color blue, and then Jar, J-A-R. And they are a bunch of musicians from different parts of Europe, from Spain, from the Netherlands, and so on and so on. And they have quite a nice album that they've put together, very instrumental pieces. Some of these melodies you'll recognize. Others are pieces or melodies that they've written, original to them. But anyway, this is one that I really like, and I think it kind of sets the mood for tonight's program, The Icons of Love. So as we travel to San Diego to catch up with Leslie, it's a beautiful romantic Dallas. We don't play a lot of music when we do our shows because we tend to focus more on current events and so on. But I thought I would use that song to welcome Leslie, who is joining us all the way from San Diego. Leslie, this is great. We're doing this for the second year. That must be good.
Yes. I think it's become a fine tradition, and really excited that some of your listeners are willing to contribute a few couples for our Iconic Couples collection this year.
That's right. We're going to have a couple of listeners. Actually, two of them are actually going to be joining us for a few minutes to talk about their favorite couples, and you've got a few. So, in fact, Leslie, why don't we tell the audience what exactly our plan is today? We've got a great plan, lots of different couples that we'll be talking about. So why don't you give us a summary of the program?
Well, I think it can be, you know, broken up into to a few key areas. We're going to explore Victorian romance a bit. Our favorite military historian is going to put up the weapons and pull out the poetry tonight and talk about Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, learn about what their relationship and how it evolved. Then we're going to delve into a few of the listener choices, Gloria and Emilio Estevan, to bring in the Cuban connection everybody on this program cherishes, and as well as forget the other listener choice. Frida and Kahlo and Diego Rivera again, chiming into Latin America, the passion and romance from Mexico and how it impacted the art history of the country. We're going to return back a bit to the Victorian era by actually looking at Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, whose relationship actually transformed all of Europe. And then a sneak at American history with your homage to the Kennedys, and if we happen to have time, a bit of a homage to Ronald and Nancy Reagan, and wrapping it up with a historical couple, again, poets, writers, setting the tone of real medieval romance, Abelard and Eloise. So just a nice smattering of history and literature that I think our listeners are really going to enjoy.
I think so, and it's going to be a great lineup. As I said, it's going to be a little different format than we normally do because we normally focus on issues of the day and controversies. We're putting that aside tonight and focusing exclusively on Valentine's Day and the romance that it represents. But, you know, Leslie, just a quick note, maybe some of our listeners are not aware with the story of Valentine's Day. Of course, it goes back a long time to St. Valentine, many, many years ago. And it's interesting. I like to just, before we get to St. Valentine's, I just wanted to quickly talk about Valentine's Day in the Spanish-speaking world. It's actually a little different. It's celebrated the same day, and of course, the intent of the holiday is the same. But in Latin America, we don't call it Valentine's Day. We actually call it Lover's Day, which I think it's kind of an interesting way of describing the day. So Lover's Day is what we call it in the Spanish-speaking world, as we tonight celebrate a couple of Spanish-speaking couples, Leslie. But St. Valentine is what we call it up here.
Well, definitely, the Latin Americans, they do put a nice spin on romance, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, we're going to get started. Where do we start first?
Why don't we bring in Barry, because he's going to lead off, I think, with a proper tone, with some poetry.
All right, Barry Jacobson. Hello, Barry, how are you? Let's see, Barry. Wait a second, Barry. I pushed the wrong button. Forgive me, Barry. There you are, Barry Jacobson. How you been?
I'm better now that I have a voice.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry about that. The reason you didn't have a voice is because I hit the wrong button. So all of our listeners, I mean, you had all these women fainting out there, Barry, because they couldn't hear you.
Well, I would like to think that that's the case. I somehow doubt it, but thank you anyway. So, shall we get started here?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I am going to talk about first the two Victorian poets who carried on quite a love affair. This is Elizabeth Barrett and her husband eventually, Robert Browning. And she was very nearly the poet laureate for the British Empire, losing out to Tennyson at the time. She was quite a celebrated poet. And I'm just going to read one of her poems, which is so appropriate for Valentine's Day. And this goes out to anyone who's ever deeply loved anyone. And you probably know this. Most people do. But here's how it goes. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. If you don't know any other poem by Elizabeth Barrett, you probably know that one.
Well, I think we can end the show right now.
That's right. Yeah, they're an interesting They're very interesting couple. Let me tell you a little bit about them. Elizabeth Barrett was a very celebrated female poet of the mid-early Victorian age. She was 6 years older than Robert Browning, very well published, very well established. They met fairly late in life. She was 39 when they met. She was a spinster and, in fact, an invalid. She and her siblings had been dominated by a very wealthy and domineering father. And the Barretts lived on Wimpole Street in London. Their money came from sugar in Jamaica. They were heirs to a sugar fortune. Robert Browning himself was the son of a banker of very modest means. And he was up and coming when they met in the literary world, and they wrote a series of letters to each other, which you can find online. Wellesley College controls them. She's quite the hero, Wellesley. And the letters start out with a correspondence in 1845 that continues until their marriage in 1846. And much against her father's wishes. In fact, he cut her off financially after this. She married him and more or less eloped off to Italy, where they had one son together, Penn. And their writing together continued in poems and prose. He was a playwright as well. She died 12 years later, and he continued on for a very long time after that. But they are probably the two most celebrated poets and lovers in the Victorian age.
Barry, if you could just, for the benefit of, well, for my benefit and perhaps many listeners, if you could put a brackets on the Victorian age in terms of what years we're talking about. We're talking about Queen Victoria, obviously, right?
Yeah, she comes to the throne of England, the niece of William IV, and she's queen from the 1830s through just about the beginning of the 20th century. In fact, she died in 1900 or so.
Yeah, 1901 is like her reign started in like 1932 and then went through 1832 and went into 1901. So, you know, definitely through some very transitional periods in global history, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Now, the Victorian age is known as a time of etiquette, right, and elegance. Is that right?
It is. That could describe several ages, including going back to the Georgian age, which is colonial American age in American terms. But I guess what Victorian age is most known for is sort of a renaissance of morality, in a sense of, you know, morality returned after a fairly loose and gay period under William and under the Regency. She was very straight-laced, and so was Albert. And it was a period of real stiff upper lip and self-sacrifice for the good of the empire and the good of, you know, the nation. Very strong Christian morals. Sort of the ideal example of what that age was all about would have been somebody like Charles Gordon, General Charles Gordon, who went about liberating slaves in the Sudan and fighting, you know, heathens in China. And had a Bible under one hand and a pistol or a swagger stick in the other. And that was sort of the Victorian age. It's the age of Kipling. It's the age of Tennyson. It's the age of again, Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning.
But I'd like to expand on this a bit, since this is one of the couples I was slated to talk about. Because it you know, it is straight-laced in a way, but Victoria and Albert, we're a very passionate couple, as expressed by the very numerous children that they had. And it's true that if you think about where their parents' era came from, time of King George the Fourth and all his brothers who were having numerous affairs, and royal scandals were prevalent, and they led a very large life on the, you know, London tabloids. So when Charles the Fourth had a daughter who unfortunately died, it became apparent that one of the brothers was going to inherit. It was a big race to have the brothers to have children of their own for more heirs. And what happened is, Victoria's father struck it lucky because he actually married somebody who was quite fertile and proved her for fertility. And Victoria carried on that fine tradition herself by bearing essentially a lot of progenitors of the future European royal dynasties. So that was kind of interesting. And they met each other when they were fairly young, and in fact, before Victoria took the throne. And it was always understood that they were to be married because, in fact, Albert was groomed to be her spouse. And one of the reasons he was so straight-laced is because people wanted to get away from the large living, as Victoria herself did. And so he was groomed to essentially be this, but it didn't actually fit in his more, you know, shyer, less outgoing personality than his older brother, who ran into many problems later on in his life because many affairs and his own scandalous style of living. So they were a well-matched couple even from the beginning, but they truly did fall in love and were married in actually close to Valentine's Day, February 10th, 1840. And Victoria writes that this was the happiest day of her life, that it was bliss beyond her imagining. And subsequently, their 8 children were born, and it's interesting to see the fallout and where the grandkids entered and how the kind of, you know, strict upbringing and the style of parenting was emulated throughout the entire country. And, in fact, many of the American style of parenting comes from that era, too, so it impacted us as well. Only coming out in the, you know, in the 1900s, you know, getting away from that very, you know, controlled, you know, strict, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child attitude toward parenting. And again, but they were very passionate. They loved each other, as testified by the many children. They really enjoyed a rich physical life. Victoria herself hated to be pregnant. She didn't like little kids. Found it a big nuisance, but again, she came from a very fertile family, which is why the reason she was on the throne. And when Albert died in 1861 of what they thought was typhoid, but a new finding looking at the data indicates he might have suffered from a genetically induced Crohn's disease, she wrote a note that said that she wanted to join Albert in his grave, that he would be very happy if she did not live much longer than he did. And yet she was to live close to 40 years afterwards.
If I can jump in here, something that Elizabeth Barrett wrote to Robert Browning is something that I think many lovers would share, many couples would share these thoughts and this feeling. Certainly Victoria and Albert would have. But she wrote, "I love you not only for what you are, but for what I am when I'm with you." Hmm. And that to me is epitomizes what love is all about when it works, when it's good, which is that it makes you a better person.
Yes, that's a good point.
And it makes you, it makes you want to be a better person
for
the person you love.
Barry, I've got a couple of questions about the Victorian age before we move on. Two things that happened. Please tell me if I'm right on this. the Industrial Revolution and Charles Dickens, right, happened during the Victorian age.
Well, actually, Dickens, you're absolutely correct. Dickens comes along in the 1820s, and actually a little earlier than that. But he comes to his fruition in the 1820s and continues writing. And he is instrumental in many of the social changes that occurred during that period. Some of his writing is very pointed, as is Elizabeth Barrett. She was a big abolitionist, even though her family comes from slave owners in Jamaica. She wrote some poems that really influenced the abolitionist movement in the 1830s, late 1820s in England. England abolished slavery, by the way, in 1833, long before the United States did. And Dickens also, both her and Dickens worked together to abolish, or at least to influence, child labor laws in England. It's hard to believe today, but back then it was considered to be a huge step in the right direction to only allow children to work 10 hours a day in the factories, particularly right. The linen factories and textile factories. So the 10-hour work week was, or 10-hour work day was considered to be a big step, which is what they achieved. As your other thing, the Industrial Revolution actually begins earlier. It begins before the Victorian age. And it does reach its epitome during that period, but it begins much earlier.
Yeah. Well, clearly all the books that Dickens wrote, I mean, were about, you know, children and social conditions in that time. Let me turn it to Leslie.
You know, I was going to say, I pretty much, you know, touched upon Victoria and Albert. Are either of our listeners poised to, you know, contribute?
We have with us, let me put him on. We have with us the first of our listeners, and that's Fernando Hernandez, who is calling us from Miami. Fernando is the author of a book called Cuban Americans, Our Footprints in America. Our footsteps. What is it, Fernando? Footsteps or footprints? I want to make sure I get it right.
Well, good evening, everybody.
Yes.
title of the book is The Cubans, Our Footprints Across America.
There we go. I should know that. I apologize. But Fernando is a great friend of our show. And he's going to be, I want you to say hello to Leslie and Barry Jacobson.
Hey,
hi, Fernando.
Leslie and Barry, I have enjoyed your dissertation about Victorian times and those wonderful poets, and it's really a credit to you folks to bring out so much interesting information for the rest of us.
Well, see, here's a little secret, Fernando. Barry was a special forces soldier with the U.S. Army. You know, most people don't know that there was a romantic side to our special forces, right, Barry?
I like to think of myself as a warrior poet, which is an ancient and honorable tradition among warriors.
There you go. You're exactly right. Well, Fernando has written extensively about Cuban Americans in the United States, and one of the most popular, certainly one of the most prominent of these Cuban American couples is Gloria Estefan and her husband Emilio Estefan. So, Fernando, take it away.
Okay, this is a very interesting couple. First of all, they're icons in American Latin mystical history in the United States. And just a little background about, first of all, talk about Emilio Estefan. He left Cuba with his father, and they headed towards Spain. And they were there for about a year and a half, and then Emilio came to the United States when he was a teenager. As a typical Cuban immigrant, he lived in an apartment with about 15 other people in Miami until they got their, until they got settled. He started his musical career actually playing in some clubs in Miami. That's what he did. He started playing in basically an Italian restaurant and during the weekends, and he organized a band with other Cuban boys called the Miami Latin Boys until a very pretty and talented young lady by the name of Gloria Fajardo joined the group, and then they had to change the name, obviously, to Miami Sound Machine. That young lady, Gloria Fajardo, turned out to be in the future Gloria Estefan, his wife. Emilio Estefan is a musical genius. He is a marketing genius. He has produced recordings for such stars like Shakira, John Secada, Mexican singing idol Alejandro Fernandez, Antalia, Ricky Martin, Mark Anthony, Jennifer Lopez. He's just a musical guru. Now, Gloria Estefan, on the other hand, she also was born in Cuba, but she came to the United States at a very early age. Her father fought in the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, and later he fought in the Vietnam War. He died apparently of being exposed to Agent Orange. Gloria Estefan was a very bright student here in Miami. She attended the University of Miami, and she was very fluent in French, English, and Spanish. As a matter of fact, she wanted the CIA wanted to recruit Gloria Estefan because of her multiple language capabilities, but she decided to stick to music, thank God. One thing about them as a couple, they are a very loving couple. They have been married for many years, and Emilio Estefan, he's a very good father in terms of when his daughter, Emily, was growing up and going to school, he would get up very early to fix her breakfast, and he's a hard-working person, Emilio Estefan I'm referring to. He gets up basically at 5 o'clock every day, including holidays and Sundays, and he's got an agenda, and he goes to the agenda, and he works the entire day.
Nice.
He, one of his books, because he has also written some books, he says that he has ADD, which is hard to believe in such a successful person. Now, one thing about Emilio Estefan and Gloria Estefan, there are some very funny stories. One of the stories is that he took Gloria Estefan to a shopping center at one time and dropped her off. And when he went to get to get his car in the parking lot, the car was not there. So he called the cops and he said, somebody stole my car. What actually happened was he took her car to the shopping center. And when he came out, he thought he had driven his car, and that's why he thought the car was stolen. That's one of the things about Emilio Estefan. He can laugh at himself. He's a little bit like a space cadet at times. First of all, do you guys have any questions?
No, it's actually very interesting.
Yes, and
thank
of
you,
course,
thank you.
And of course, the one thing about Gloria Estefan is the one song that, you know, her song Conga, which became, you know, one of the biggest songs of the 1980s. I think that was the song that really made her an international superstar, and, you know, she continues her career. She's absolutely amazing. One thing I wanted to say about Emilio before we move on, Fernando, Emilio is the son or grandson, I'm not sure son or grandson, of Lebanese immigrants in Cuba. There were many, many Lebanese immigrants who came to Cuba in the early 20th century, and he's the son or grandson of one of those immigrants, Fernando.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. Many of the Lebanese immigrants in Cuba dedicated themselves to either the textile industry or the jewelry business as well. One thing about Gloria Estefan is that she is considered the most successful Cuban-American entertainer of all time, and also probably one of the most successful, if not the most successful, crossover performer in Latin music to date. Just very briefly, she has sold over 90 million albums worldwide,
wow,
including over 26 million just in the United States. One thing about both of these folks is that they're very, very simple. Emilio and Gloria Estefan are very much involved in community affairs in the Miami area. They contribute greatly to charity. They're involved in many organizations. So people really have a genuine love for these people. You know, there has never been a scandal regarding Gloria or Emilio Estefan. And they're just regular folks,
Didn't
right.
she have a terrible accident?
Yes, she had an accident way back in the late 1980s, where she was traveling in a big bus going on a tour, and it was an accident caused by another driver, and they feared she was going to be paralyzed. But thanks to the great medical assistance that she received, the medical treatment, plus her determination and great strong will, she was able to get back to her normal life. It was at one time that doctors told Emilio Estefan that they thought that she would never be able to walk. Mm-hmm. But she overcame those obstacles and came back. As a matter of fact, I was, along with my wife and my children, we attended her comeback tour that began in Miami, and it was called Coming Out of the Dark. And it was a very emotional experience coming out and singing that song as a way of saying, I'm back.
Yes, that is exactly right. Well, Fernando, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. Leslie Berry, any questions for Fernando?
I have one last question.
Sure.
For us Cuban music newbies, because Silvio's been, you know, acquainting me with various Latin American rhythms, what would be the three songs you would recommend me to download that best represent their music, the best ones?
Or
Gloria
Estefan?
Mm-hmm.
Gloria Estefan? Well, definitely I would recommend the song Conga. Conga, Conga.
Okay.
That's very typical Cuban African music, which is with the drums, etc. I think you will enjoy that. The conga song, definitely. I would also recommend, for example, there's so many songs, but I would also recommend a song called Can't Stay Away From You, which is a very romantic song. And also another song that is also a romantic type of song called Words Get in the Way.
Yes, that's the one. That last one is the one I was going to recommend, Leslie. And there's also one more, if I may just quickly say. There's an album that she recorded of her own music, I mean her own recordings, her own compositions that she dedicated to the Cuban heritage, and it's called Mi Tierra, which literally means My Land. And it's a great album, and it's all original compositions. And, of course, with Gloria Estefan, you also get the videos that go with it, which they're also very, very exciting. But, Fernando, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's absolutely great.
Thank you so much for the invitation, and it was nice chatting with your other guest here. And just very quickly, if anybody may be interested in reading some segments of my book, The Cubans, Our Footprints Across America, just go to Amazon.com and you'll be able to read some interesting articles there. Thank you so much.
And my pleasure, Fernando. And we have a link of your book on the show information, as we always do. But congratulations. It's a great book, and thank you for your participation tonight. Leslie, I thought that was great, that presentation by Fernando.
Yes, it is. Now, is your other listener available by
Absolutely.
Chance?
Absolutely. But before we do that, let's just take a quick break. Before we get to Tercy, let's take a quick break and go up to Minnesota. I want to say hello to our friend Aaron Clary, who has promised me that not only is he going to talk about his brand-new book, but he's got something romantic to say. So, Aaron, take it away.
I did have something romantic. I was just going to say Leslie Eastman is the only Valentine for me. So that's the only thing I was going to say romantic.
So that's your romantic. Is that your romantic contribution to Icons of Love?
Well, I'm Irish. I don't know. I could give you some whiskey and some sheep. I don't really. I wrote a poem for a girl one time called "Your Kisses Are Sweeter Than Beer." But that didn't really help at all. That didn't help. It was a failure.
No, I have a feeling you didn't get that date. I have a feeling.
It was not a success in the Aaron Clary lexicon.
No, that didn't work out. Well, you have a brand new book. Take a minute and tell us about your book. I know it's doing quite well.
Yeah, it's doing good. It's called Bachelor Pad Economics, and basically it is a financial advice guide for men of all ages and women as well, but it is tailored towards men with the language and kind of references. And basically it is designed that you could pick it up at 14, and it will guide you in making all the major and minor financial and economic decisions throughout your life. And in a hope that you will do better than basically me or the people that have preceded you. So it's kind of like if you didn't have a dad, you didn't have an older brother, or maybe your parents just weren't financially savvy, which a lot of parents aren't, this guides you saying, okay, look, here's what you should learn to fix cars. You should learn about computers by the time you graduate from high school. Then you go on to college. You should choose these majors, not those majors. Here's what you can expect in terms of career. Here's what retirement planning looks like. Don't buy fancy cars. Look out for girls. They're dangerous. And the only woman to marry is Leslie Eastman. And if you don't have her, too bad. And then, and then that goes all the way up to estate planning, where you set up a living will, nursing home insurance, retirement planning, estate planning, stuff like that.
Well, that sounds like a great gift. Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you for making this like the best Valentine's ever. You really touched me in the heart, sweetie.
Yes. Yes. See, that's what you meant by romantic. That's what you meant by romantic. You said something nice to Leslie, and we're all very happy that you did that. And you can get the book at Amazon, right, Aaron?
Correct. Yeah. Amazon, it's both available in paperback and Kindle. You just click on, search for Bachelor Pad Economics, and it'll take you right there.
Thank you so much, Aaron, for joining us tonight. It's always a great honor, and much success with your book. I know you're having it, and we're very happy that you're having success with it.
All right. Thanks, guys. We'll see you later.
All right. We're going to take a little musical break here, as we're doing tonight on this Valentine's Day, and we'll be back with more. How do you like the music tonight?
It's excellent, Silvio. You really did an outstanding job for this evening.
Yes, we made, I'll say so myself, we made some pretty good selection. That was a very nice Spanish guitar. Now, we do have our other friend of the show, Tercy, on with us right now. And let's put her on, and she's going to talk about Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. So, Leslie, let me have you say hello to Tercy. And, Tercy, say hello to Leslie and to Barry, please.
Hi, Tercy. You have such a beautiful name.
Thank you so much. There's a story about that, and I'll tell you about it someday.
Well, good how long be... is it? You got me excited.
Long.
How long is it?
No, I'll tell you another time.
Okay, all right. Well, okay, because, I mean, you got me thinking. Now. I'm going to be thinking about this forever, but it's not Teresa, is it?
No, it's not Teresa. I say diminutive of Esther.
Really?
Estercita. Do you hear Terci in there? Estercita. Do you hear Terci?
Yes, I do. Now, what
okay,
you said,
real
it's...
quickly, the lie, because it is a lie, is that my dad said when I was 2 years old, I would get into everything. And I was able, like, to pull toilet paper and not break it, like, for a good bit of the house, just walk around with the toilet paper, get into a big can that had brown sugar and all the kind of things that two-year-olds get into. And I'm my mother's namesake. So he started calling me Estercita, and Estercita was too long. By the time he said Estercita, I was already into a lot of trouble. So Estercita means little Esther. So he started calling me Terci, and I've been Terci since I was 2 years old.
All right.
So that's the story.
Well, Terci is such a neat person, Leslie and Barry, because She makes her living telling stories. She's a professional storyteller. What a wonderful way to make a living. She goes out and she talks to kids, and she tells them stories, and her storytelling skills are just phenomenal. So I just want everybody to know that you have a website, don't you, where people can go.
I do have a website.
And people can go there.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead and say it. You say it.
No, www.terseybendiburg.com.
Right.
And it needs upgrading because I'm not a business person, but it is a good website.
It is a good website. You actually have videos and all of that on there. So you have a, and you tell all kinds of stories, and many of your stories are for children, which is a wonderful thing. Now, you're going to tell us, Leslie, Terce is going to tell us about Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, one of the, I guess, iconic couples of Mexico, especially.
Actually, on one list, the list of the most torrid lovers in history, they made number one. So Terce is going to have a fascinating story on this, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
Well, I wanted to say that, first of all, I'm glad to be with the three of you. Thank you so much for having me for a little bit during the show tonight. I want to say that I'm not empapada, which means my knowledge is very thin, okay, concerning Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, but I am interested and have been interested in their lives for a long time. There's a saying in Spanish that says that Dios los hace y el diablo los cría. I think that's how it goes. Isn't that how it goes?
Yeah, that's how it goes.
No,
but
yeah,
I think
el diablo lo junta. No, el diablo lo junta, which means God makes them and the devil puts them together. So I wanted to say that this is not going to be a sweet story like what Fernando told us tonight about
Emilio and Gloria.
Thank you.
Yeah, Emilio and Gloria.
I'm 60. Okay, sometimes it just goes. But anyway, it's a very different kind of story. I did want to say something that what Barry said is true about I love you not only for what you are but what I am when I'm with you. And I think it is true that when it works, it's really great and it works that way. Good couples bring out the best in one another. Unfortunately, this too, although I think they really did care for one another, didn't always do that. She had a hard life. When she was 6, she had polio. When she was 17, she was in a very bad accident, a horrible accident, and she had to have many surgeries after that, and she was traspasada. How do you say that in English? A piece of metal went through her pelvis and uterus, making her unable to have children in the future. And in one of the things that I read about her, it says that she had this accident in 1926, when she was recovering, she wrote a birth certificate to an imaginary child that she would never have. And there's even a copy of it online, and the birth certificate is to a boy named Leonardo. Now, she wasn't pregnant or anything at that time. Okay, this was just, I guess, a longing, thinking that she would never have it. And the baby was supposed to have been born in the Red Cross Hospital, which is where she was treated after she had her accident. And if you know anything about her work, many of her paintings have to do with childbirth or miscarriages and not being able to reproduce. Of the 100-something paintings that she did, 55 are of herself. And a lot of the time she painted when she had to rest, she was in very, very horrible pain at times. And so it was real interesting how she came to know Rivera, not necessarily in the way that they met, but her baggage. She loved her dad very, very much, and apparently he used to do puppet shows and things like that for her and for her sister, and he kind of like encouraged the creative side. She had not thought of being an artist to begin with. She wanted to be a doctor, and it was later after the accident that while she was recuperating, she was in a full-body cast. She started painting. But what's interesting to me is that she came to Rivera with lots of pain already, not just physical pain, but also emotional pain. And she was very young. She was 20 years younger than he was. And she admired his work, and she met him, and he encouraged her work. And in time, a romantic relationship developed, and then they were married. She was his third wife at that time. And when they met, he was still married to his second wife. And she was always jealous of that second wife because they had two daughters. And I think he had a daughter by the first wife, too, a son by the first wife. But for some reason, there was something about that second wife that bothered her. When her parents met him, they were fine as long as he was just encouraging her creative side. But when they realized they were going to be married to one another, they call him the elephant, and they call her the dove. El elefante y la paloma. That's who they were. That's what the kind of couple they were going to be. He was huge. He was a very tall man, weighed about 300 pounds. She was 5'3", and when they married, she weighed 98 pounds. She did get pregnant, and because the baby was not in a good position in her uterus, because of the accident, the way her uterus was deformed, she had an abortion. Following that, there's a miscarriage, and she paints about this. Both of them had numerous affairs. They divorce at one time because she finds out that he's having an affair with her younger sister, and she feels so betrayed by both. And in time, she's able to forgive her little sister. This is the youngest. And she develops a relationship, not a love affair, with a doctor who was a friend of Rivera's. And this doctor, who becomes her friend till the very end of her life, and they write letters to one another, he encourages her to open her heart to Rivera again, and he encourages Rivera to marry her again. And so they remarry. And even though they remarry, they keep having affairs, okay? She has an affair with Trotsky, the Russian, the communist. Ideologically, they were both communist. There's a side of them that's very endears me to them, and it's the sense that they really love the indigenous people of Mexico. And also in their paintings, in their work, the indigenous people of Mexico were very important. And it's almost like instead of turning their back and rejecting that part of their heritage, even though their heritage was, her father was German, her mother was Indian, Spanish Indian, so part Indian, part Spanish. He was 6 feet something, and his mother was Rivera's mother was a Jewish, came from a family of Jewish of conversos, which means that they had converted during the Inquisition, so that they could remain in Spain. So I don't know how much indigenous blood they actually had. She probably had more than he did. I'm not sure, but they did embrace that simplicity and the music and the colors and the crafts of the people. Of the least of these, and so I don't see their communism, and this is a hard thing for a Cuban woman to say. I don't see their communism in the same way that I see communism in Cuba. I don't even want to go into that topic for too long. But I do know that when I first went to Mexico as a little girl, when I left Cuba, I was 10 years old, and then when I went back twice, there's really not a middle class at that time. The last time I was there, my boy, who's 32 now, was 2 years old. So things may have changed, but there was a very very rich class in a very poor class, in almost a non-existent middle class. And so unlike people who had been born to money, as Diego had, or had made something of themselves, they did not turn their back of the least of them. And so that really truly endears me to them. Something I found out today reading about them is that Diego fell in love with Maria Felix. You know who Maria Felix is, Silvio?
Well, she's the big-time movie actress, right?
Movie actress. And
yeah.
He almost divorced Frida a second time, thinking that Maria Felix would marry him.
I'm trying to think of a comparable, forgive me for a second, I'm trying to think of a comparable American to Maria Felix. Maria Felix, in I guess in the 40s, this would be the 40s.
Rita Hayworth?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, she was an absolutely beautiful woman who was a leading actress in all the Spanish movies of the time. And, yeah, I mean, she was just an absolutely beautiful woman, yeah.
So anyway, she becomes very, very ill towards the end of her life, and there are rumors that she might have had she might have committed suicide by something that she took. They're not certain of that, but she died, and like 4 years later or 3 years later, he died as well. And he saved her. He had her cremated, and he kept her ashes. And his desire was that their ashes be joined, and then they would be laid to rest in the same place. And it didn't happen. His wife at the time and two daughters decided that he should be buried. I don't know if he was cremated, but his remains buried in a special historical place in the city of Mexico. And I can't remember La Rotunda. Something about La Rotunda. Rotunda is like a circular place with a statue in the middle or something, where cars drive around. I think that's what I remember reading. And so they didn't end up being together at the end of their lives. She ended her life, most of her life, she ended in the house where she was born, que es la Casa Azul, the blue house. And the house has a certain color, a very interesting color of blue, that when you look at that blue, you think of Kahlo. Of Frida Kahlo. And for a time, even after they got together, they each had their own home. They lived, that's the way they were able to live together. He says after she died that he never realized that he had loved her that much, or that she was the one that he had loved, that had been the love of his life. But anyway, like I started saying at the beginning, Dios los hace, God makes them, y el diablo lo junta, and the devil puts them together. So that's my contribution.
Well, I think you did a great job, didn't she, Leslie?
Yeah, yes, absolutely fascinating. And the really thing highlights the tempestuous relationship they had, and definitely it inspired a lot of their artwork.
Yes.
Right,
and
their artwork. Well, I love their artwork.
Yes.
Especially I have one of his I have a print. I don't have anything original, but I have the girl with the sunflowers. And yes, I like their work. So thank you so much for having me tonight.
No, thank you.
Are you there?
Yes,
no,
thank
no,
you for joining us.
Yeah, thank
and
you
I
for
will
joining
stay,
us.
I will go online so I can keep listening to you guys, okay? I'm going to hang up
that
now.
Would be, thank you very much, Thirsty. Thirsty, one more time, your website.
www.Thirsty, Bendeberg, B-E-N, D as in David, I-B-U-R-G, .com.
Thank you so much.
Thirstybendeberg.com. And I most of what I do is folklore. I tell folk tales with music and instruments. I do
That's
a lot
right.
of I have a lot of music in my stories. All right.
Yes.
Take care.
Thank you so much. She's a really neat lady, Leslie and Barry. And I think the story, you're right, Leslie. The story, I mean, I thought it was interesting. I didn't think it would turn out that way, but it did, you know, the great romance of Emilio and Gloria Estefan. And then followed by to say the least, a very complicated relationship there between between Frida and Diego Rivera, Leslie.
Yes, well, I think it's kind of nice. We explored Victorian concept of romance and the Latin American one. And I think given the time, there's one more I'd like to touch on before we conclude this year's program. And Barry, I'd like to turn it over to you so you can, you know, talk about the medieval couple. Because, of course, when you think romance, and often you're thinking about the great poetry and chivalry of the Middle Ages. So I think Abelard and Eloise would be a nice way to end this year's discussion.
Okay. It's time's short, so I'll get right to it. Abelard and Eloise were two very learned people in the Middle Ages in the 12th century. Peter Abelard was one of the great scholars of his time and teachers and attracted quite a following. And when he was 27, he met a student, a young girl named Eloise, and ended up being employed by her guardian, her uncle, to be her teacher. And she'd already regained some fame of her own as a scholar. In fact, she was considered in Western Europe one of the foremost female scholars. Spoke many languages, both of them did. And so there was a meeting of two great minds, in a way, and he was her teacher. Now, she is alternately either 17 when they meet in 1163, I think it was. No, it's not quite right. 11, well, I'll get the date. But in any case, when they first met in 11, well, I'll find the date here. But in any case, she was either 17 or 27. They either were the same age or she was 10 years younger. And accounts differ as to that. But they, at some point, very soon in a relationship, they had an affair. And though he was a churchman, this is before churchmen were not allowed to marry. They could still marry in this point of Catholic history. And it was quite a torrid affair behind her uncle's back, her guardian's back, and she got pregnant. And that caused all kinds of trouble. And it could have really scuttled his career in the church, because even though they were allowed to marry, he could never rise very high in church hierarchy if you were married with family. So they tried to keep it secret as long as they could. And during this period, there was a lot of tension between him and Peter and her uncle. And eventually she went to live during this period, time of her having a child and the time of this anger between her family and him. She went to live in a convent separate from him, even though they had secretly married. And during this period, her uncle and his friends got the impression he was putting her off, but they basically just locked her in a convent somewhere. And to take revenge, they attacked him one day in his quarters and held Peter Abelard down while he was castrated. After that, he went into seclusion, and for many years didn't talk to anybody. Eventually came out of seclusion. He became a churchman, an abbot. She became a prioress of a convent. And they began corresponding with each other again after all these years. And their correspondence became quite famous. Some of it was romantic, some of it was ecclesiastical. But they sort of became a famous couple during the Middle Ages, and their love, of course, cost him obviously very dearly.
How did it end? I mean, did they ever see each other again?
They did not. As far as we know, they did not see each other again, though they did correspond. And when they died, their bodies were buried together. And to this day, young couples will go to their tomb just outside of Paris, and they will lay tributes on their tomb, pieces of paper, letters to their lovers, even letters hoping they'll find true love. And they'll put it almost like as a shrine. Their tomb is a shrine to a young love.
Well, that seems like a great place to end this year's show. Thank you.
Yeah that is great. Now, what time period again, Barry? Say it again.
That was the 12th century.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah,
that the 1100s. And by the way, there's a movie about that, which if you're interested in learning more about Eloise and Abelard, it's called Stealing Heaven, and it came out in 1988. So that's something to look up.
Yes. Well, it's amazing how the time flies, but here we are just about at the end. Any other thoughts, Leslie, that you want to share with the audience? Maybe
a little tease about next year? Everybody just have a super awesome Valentine's Day. If you don't have somebody you love, go out and do something nice for yourself.
That's true. That's a nice thought. Barry, any thoughts for the audience?
Well, I just want to send a Valentine's out to Leslie, my good friend, and all my other good friends out there that I've known over the years. And in particular, I just got an email from my very first girlfriend ever, somebody that I had kept in correspondence with over the years. We met when I was 18, and she was 17, and we still correspond.
Great.
So I just want to send a Valentine's wish out to Allison in Key West.
Great. Now, she's listening to the show?
I think she is. I told her I was going to be on the show, and I think she'll be listening in.
Oh, great. Well, that's wonderful. My thanks to both of you for joining me again. We'll get into more of our typical topics on future shows. But, Leslie, you were telling me that next year we might do some sciences. Is that right?
Well, there's a lot that we left on the chopping block this year, including Marie and Pierre Curie. So I jettisoned them in honor of the poets and writers in the group this year. Next year we'll hit the sciences because scientists can be lovers too.
That's right. That's right. And you yourself, you're a scientist, aren't you?
Definitely. So.
So you are. Well, I want to thank both of you so much, and I also want to say Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. And I hope you all have a wonderful time tomorrow. To everybody, enjoy yourselves. My wife and I will be enjoying Valentine's Day. We have a tradition at our church here, St. Catherine of Siena, that every Valentine's Day weekend we have what they call a special dance for Valentine's, and it's a lot of fun. We get to see a lot of friends, and we get to take a lot of pictures. So it's a fun activity, and it's just something we've been doing for several years. So we'll have some fun doing that. But, Leslie, thank you again. Any tips, any hint about next week, Leslie?
Oh, yes. We have booked Charles Pettinger, who will be discussing Bitcoin. People are getting more interested in Bitcoin. So we'll have a California and finance update and take a look at what's behind Bitcoin and is it a good thing or something you'd be skeptical of.
Oh, okay. Well, great. I'm looking forward to that. And Barry, any information about anything you're working on your blog you want to share with us?
Yes. If you go to my blog, Deadliest Blogger, I've got an ongoing series on the wars of the successors, John Alexander the Great. There's a lot of great articles, I think, throughout my blog, and someone can go explore that. But the most current is the wars of the successors, the real-life Macedonian Game of Thrones.
All right. Well, we'll definitely do that. So, Leslie, thank you. Barry, thank you. And thank you to the audience. We went a little bit longer tonight, but I wanted to make sure we got all of the information in. Good night, everybody, and happy Valentine's Day. Good night, Leslie. Good night,
Silvio.
Good night,
happy Barry. Valentine's Day.
Yes.